Hello everyone, and welcome to this second episode of the 2022 Politics Show from the University of Reading. This week on the show we have Tamara Dean, Faris Al-Assaid, Donna Logan and myself, Daniel Thine. We will be doing a featured documentary piece on fear and instability in the political world. We will also be looking at and reacting to this week's Brit Awards, and we also have a segment on the debate of university housing. Is it better to live in university halls, or is it better to live in private housing flats separate from the university? But first, the news from me and Tamara. In local news, the Reading Beer and Cider Festival for 2022, the organisers have cancelled for the third year in a row, but festival organisers have cited issues to do with the pandemic behind reasons for its cancellation. Two men from Berkshire have pleaded guilty in connection to the death of Beau Robinson, which occurred in June last year in Burnham. Daniel Hicks, 31, and Martin Fleming, 20, have been prosecuted for manslaughter.
Now on national news, Keir Starmer, leader of the UK Labour Party, was attacked by protesters after Boris Johnson falsely accused him of failing to prosecute sex offender Jimmy Savile. Cressida Dick resigns as Metropolitan Police Chief Commissioner after a slew of scandals. Brit Awards 2022, Adele won in three nominations, including Song of the Year and Artist of the Year. More about Brits further in the show.
In international news, the ex-pope has admitted errors in handling of the abuse cases. Former Pope Benedict has admitted mistakes were made in the handling of sexual abuse cases while he was in office as the Archbishop of Munich. This is coming in response to a report by a German law firm. He has said there were indeed grievous faults, but he has denied any personal wrongdoing. Following the tensions in Ukraine, it is now being questioned further if diplomacy will de-escalate the tension, as the Prime Minister hoped after sending the Defence Secretary for talks at the Foreign Ministry, with US President Joe Biden telling all US citizens to leave Ukraine and is quoted saying, things could go crazy.
And finally, UK ticket holder wins almost £110 million in Euro Millions lottery. The UK's biggest ever Euro Millions jackpot, £170 million, was won by anonymous ticket holder in the draw on October 8th, 2019. Talk about luck of the draw.
And now we have our segments on accommodation. We interviewed some students on whether they preferred living in student accommodation or private housing, and these are their responses.
So have you lived in halls and private residences as well?
I've lived in both halls and a private residence.
So which one do you prefer?
I think I definitely prefer halls.
Why do you prefer halls to private residence?
Halls are much easier, in my opinion, even in terms of like trash, like recycling and all of those things. There's usually like one big bin that you can take all your trash to, rather than actively like separating them all the time. Also in halls, there are way less noise complaints, barely ever any, and I feel like halls are more like a welcome, like you feel more welcome because like there are more students, so it's like you get used to the place easily.
So do you think houses are student friendly, or do you think there are student friendly houses?
I don't really think houses are student friendly. I think it's a lot of work. I also think you have to pay extra as compared to hall, because you separately pay for like electricity bills and Wi-Fi every month and everything. So I think, especially for students who don't work and are trying to like fund for themselves, I definitely think halls are better, because you just pay. Like once you pay everything at once, there are no extra bills.
Yeah. So have you had any bad experiences in any of them?
Halls, no. Private residence, yes. I've had a bad neighbor who always complains about nothing, so it's kind of stressful.
Do you think the university does anything to help with like issues like neighbors for students?
I think they try with their disciplinary meetings to like not just assume what the people are saying are true, but like they also want to hear your side rather than making an assumption, and that's better rather than them just thinking that you are in the wrong. They make an effort to hear both sides, because sometimes what the universe may be saying may not always be the case.
So have you had really good experiences in each of them, or what are like your best experiences in each of them?
I think private residence, my good experience is that I lived with my friends, so you just never felt lonely. And in hall, so I got to meet new people. So I guess that was nice.
Yeah. If you could change one thing about each of them, what would it be?
I wouldn't change anything about the hall, but definitely private residence. I think they should take the recycling thing. They should be more understanding about it, because a lot of us are new to this setting. Like, we don't have to do this in our home countries. And moving here is just very hard for us to, like, do the recycling thing and all. And also, maybe the walls in private residence, apparently they are very thin, which is why the neighbors keep complaining, so.
So, if you had to recommend someone to live in either halls or private residences, what would you recommend?
Definitely halls.
Okay, lastly, do you think the cost of private residences make it worth the negative, or the disadvantages of it? Do you think the cost makes it worth it, because it turns out to be a bit cheaper than accommodation?
I don't think private residence is cheaper than accommodation when you add everything together in terms of the bills you pay every month. Because sometimes the light bills and stuff can get really high, and when they add up,
they're about the same.
We also have an interview from a student with a contrasting opinion.
Interview 3. Okay, so have you lived in both accommodation and private residences?
Yeah, I've lived in halls and in a house.
And which do you prefer?
I think I prefer a house.
You prefer a house to halls? Yeah. And okay, why do you prefer living in a house to halls?
I think it's nice to have like a big space, like there's a lot more room. It's nice living with people like in a quite close environment.
Mm-hmm. So, do you think there are any negative aspects to living in both a house and accommodation?
So, with accommodation, it was really, really good. It felt really safe, and everything with the security. So that was, like, a big advantage. In a house, I think because you're living in, like, a community, it can get a bit difficult with the neighbours sometimes. So that would be disadvantage of a house.
Yeah, and do you think the university does anything to help with like disputes with neighbors and tenants, like student tenants and stuff?
I think they definitely deal with it. I don't know if it's in like a fair way, but they do kind of help to deal with it if help is needed, I guess.
Yeah. Have you had any bad experiences in each?
In halls, I think the security was really good, but it got quite a lot. Like, they had access to your rooms and stuff. They could just come in anytime they wanted. In the house, just literally the neighbours kind of making complaints, and then our agent having to deal with it, and then the uni as well. That's a disadvantage, I think.
Yeah, so if you could change anything about each one, what would it be?
So with the house, I think just kind of more understanding from both the agent and the neighbours, although I don't really know if that, like, is very easy to change. With halls, I think I think halls was quite good. I don't think I changed anything about halls.
So if you had to recommend to someone to live in either halls or houses, which one would you recommend?
Either halls or a house. I'd say a house. Like, even though some of our experiences haven't been the best in a house. I think for the most part, you won't really be around neighbours that complain all the time.
Yeah. And do you think, what do you think about the cost of living in a house versus a versus university accommodation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's definitely more expensive to live in halls. Like, even though you get a lot of kind of things thrown in, like everything's included, like they even kind of clean the kitchen and clean within the accommodation. It's all really good and it's really easy if you want that, but a house is definitely a better option if you want to save money.
Yeah, and do you think, so for students that are living in a house, do you think the like disadvantages, like you spoke about the neighbors and stuff, do you think that's still worth it to get a house?
I mean, I don't know. I think if there's going to be kind of a lot of things happening in the house, then it probably wouldn't be the best option. For example, like if you're going to have a lot of people over all the time, which would definitely kind of add to the noise, then I wouldn't say it's a good option, because obviously you have to, as well as that, there's a lot of kind of things you have to do on your own, like paying bills and maintaining the house. So if you kind of just want an easy living experience, I'd say halls. But if you kind of want to feel more like an adult and kind of more kind of independent, then I'd say a house.
And have you made like most of living in accommodation or a house? And do you think, which one do you think is easier with meeting new people?
Mm-hmm. I think with accommodation, it's obviously really easy to meet people because you're in like a massive building with loads of people and you can kind of go to each other's apartments and stuff. So I think probably I'd say halls would be better for meeting people.
Mm-hmm. And is that how you met most of your friends from uni now? Would you say most of your friends are made up from living in accommodation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so, definitely.
Anything about one of them, what would it be?
About either a house or accommodation?
Mm-hmm. If you could change one thing about each of them.
One thing about accommodation, maybe make it, I don't know, less expensive. And then with the house, just make it kind of like a more easy living environment, I think, with like in terms of the people who live around you, so that it's like mainly students.
And do you think houses are student friendly?
Yeah, I think so, for the most part.
So Faris, do you think private residence and accommodations are about the same cost, considering what the students and have said in experience?
Well, it depends on what you consider cost, to be honest, because like when it comes to just straight up money, I feel like they are about the same. But you have to also keep in mind that sometimes there is a transport cost, there is utility bills, council taxes, which end up making private residences more expensive than actually staying in university dorms.
Do you think there are any benefits of living in private residences?
I feel like both of them have benefits, to be honest. The benefits of living in private accommodation is, as they said, living independently, trying to live as an adult for the first time in your life, which is a great experience. And ultimately, the freedom is the biggest benefit of living in private residences. But living in university dorms also has a ton of benefits. First of all, having access to so many potential friends is a great plus. Being able to literally walk to the lake, which is like less than a minute away, is amazing to have. Having the park bar right next to you is also a great experience.
Have you had any bad experiences in university accommodation? Because I know loads of people have.
I've had bad experiences, but I'd say those bad experiences, I look back at them and smile, to be honest. Like one of my favorite experiences was finding someone's bathroom door in an elevator without any reason for it being there. But yeah.
Yeah, and the students spoke about security. Do you think security is an issue with private residences and in university accommodation? Because they did speak about how people could just come into their rooms with accommodation.
When it comes to security, I feel like I've never had issues with either one. But when they were talking about someone coming into their room, it was actually the university security. And I feel like, yeah, in those terms, I feel like it's, to be honest, too much. I feel like we should be entitled to some privacy, and for them to come into accommodations without actually requesting access is too much.
So it seems like you've said a lot of good things about halls. So would you say the distance from town is worth it?
It's really hard for me to decide, to be honest. I love halls and I love private accommodation. I just kind of go with the flow.
Yeah, and would you recommend halls or private accommodation to somebody that was looking for a place to stay?
If it's your first time actually living alone, I'd recommend halls, just to make some friends, just to get comfortable with your surroundings. And then I'd recommend going to private residences.
So some of the students also spoke about issues with their neighbors and complaints. Have you had any of those? And like, what is your opinion of them and what the school is doing?
Actually, the only thing I ever got was from when I was living in private accommodation. And yeah, what they said before about the walls being too small or too thin is absolutely correct. Noise complaints are crazy. But in halls, never.
We will now move on to our documentary piece on fear.
To start off, I will be discussing political fear and corruption in Nigeria. The levels of corruption in Nigeria are vastly increasing, and we see this with recent case studies and testimonials of civilians such as Godwin Epo, a taxi driver that was shot in the chin by the police after a bribe was requested from him on his way home from church alongside his family. When interviewed and asked about whether the police often take bribes, he replied, "It is too common here." And this shows the level of acceptance the public now has due to how dire the situation is and the level of mistrust they now have in the police. Kemi Okenyodo, a Nigerian activist, says low salaries and a culture of impunity has led to the vast levels of corruption in Nigeria. This low level of corruption has caused fear, which has caused increased distrust for average citizens as they have no real protection and are afflicted by the forces put in place to safeguard them. They cannot report to the police, as cases can easily be turned against them, and the individuals reporting misconduct can be imprisoned for demanding justice and a reliable police force. Many rural schools are meant to receive government funding, but have not, and are in horrible states with children left without chairs, desks, books, or basic learning equipment. The 2014 federal education budget was $2.4 billion, yet these schools are in such a state of despair, and the learning environments are vastly different to the environments provided in privately funded institutions. This is due to corruption and theft from the government and individuals within it. However, people that speak out are often seen as targets or scared for their safety afterwards. Corruption in Nigeria is even seen in places of higher education, such as universities. BBC News Africa went undercover inside Nigeria universities, where they discovered the lecturers were coercing or forcing students to have sexual relations with them in order to receive good grades. This has left many students living in fear of not only speaking out, but also neglected them of the freedom to dress how they please in order not to be sexualized by their lecturers. The governing bodies of these institutions allow these crooked lecturers to get away with misconduct by vouching for their innocence in clear situations where they are wrong. And this further instills fear in students and continues the cycles of abuse. The issue is so trivialized and normalized that some students go into university expecting these immoral behaviors from their lecturers. This is a constant cycle of people in positions of power abusing it and using fear as a way of getting what they want from those that they're meant to protect. Progressive voices such as Mohammed Sanusi II, the current emir of Kano, speak out about the levels of corruption in Nigeria. He states that the Nigerian corruption is in many parts of the world, and he believes that this is due to the lack of accountability. As he plainly puts it, it is stealing. He is the second highest Islamic authority in Nigeria as the emir of Kano, but he is well known for his TEDx talk where he scrutinized the government and the lack of deployments in Nigeria due to vested interests continuing to rape the country and take the money out. At the time, he was the central bank governor and accused the former president, Goodluck Jonathan, the former petroleum minister, Alison Manduke, and the federal governor of looting $20 billion of oil wealth. He was fired as a response for his whistleblowing, and this sets a precedent for how the country responds to any scrutiny or criticism regarding leaders' behavior. If such an important figure can be fired for exposing such issues, then surely the everyday citizen such as Godwin Epple, the taxi driver, stands no chance against the government corruption. This complete loss of hope for change has created an environment of fear, especially for the Nigerian youth and the lower classes regarding what the future looks like for them, seeing as the people in positions of power are not concerned with their best interests.
The corruption faced by civilians in Nigeria penetrates all levels of society. Either through ineptitude or more malicious reasons, the Nigerian government has protected officers of SARS, also known as the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, a police unit marred by a reputation of abuse, torture, extrajudicial killing, and extortion, from facing any consequences. The civilians of Nigeria have lived in fear of those with the duty to protect them for more than 20 years. And while now is a time to heal and celebrate the dissolution of SARS, its scars remain present throughout the country. Our story of fear that many know far too well begins with the creation of Nigeria's Special Anti-Robbery Squad in 1992. The unit's main objective was to fight violent crimes that were rampant in Nigeria after the Civil War, but later became notorious for their widespread use of torture, extortion, and extrajudicial executions. The faith people have had in the government to stop such illegal behaviors has been met with committee after committee investigating alleged abuses, with no real action being done and no officer ever being prosecuted. This caused the Nigerian population to have less faith and growing distrust towards the Nigerian government. And the Nigerian government have pledged to reform SARS since 2015, but have fallen short of these multiple pledges many times. The situation reached a boiling point in 2020, when public outcry and protests against the unit's abuse and the government's lack of action increasing. The movement End SARS, hashtag End SARS, gained traction, where tens of thousands of young protesters went to the streets to pressure the government for the dissolution of SARS and the prosecution of officers involved. While the government officially dissolved the unit, officers were not prosecuted or fired, but rather they moved into different police units. Will the disbandment of SARS solve police brutality issues in Nigeria? Will the Nigerian population be able to live without fear of police brutality looming over their head? While these are important questions that have to be investigated, they are for another episode. For now, our documentary of fear takes us to Kazakhstan with our co-presenters Tamara Dean and Daniel Thine.
On the 2nd of January 2022, in Kazakhstan, protests began to break out, triggered by the rising fuel prices despite the country's rich natural resources, but also potentially charged by a desire in the country for political change. But the response to these riots has put fear into the hearts of the nation. Initially, in response to protests breaking out, the president, Kassym Jomart Tokayev, offered to rescind fuel prices, accepted, or perhaps demanded, the resignations of his cabinet and prime minister, and announced that he would replace the still influential former president of almost three decades, Nursultan Nazarbayev, as head of the powerful National Security Council. All of this was done in response to protests starting, but even following the tensions still seemed to escalate. According to official sources, more than 160 people have been killed so far and 8,000 have been detained, as per the Interperimeter website. These detainments include the former head of state, Kislov, who was detained after starting what he claimed were peaceful protests that turned violent when other protesting factions arrived. Kislov described the group that joined them as an unruly mob of what seemed more like thugs than any kinds of people, with reports of protesters beheading the opposition in the streets. This detainment, however, increases the fear aspects for the Kazakh people who are trying to exercise their opinion and speak out, but this is leading to potential detainment and censorship from the government. After about a week, the state claimed victory after Russian and CSTO, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, troops were deployed to the streets against the protesters who had apparently been hijacked by external militant and terrorist forces. This is alarming to the people of Kazakhstan, as CSTO troops are only supposed to be deployed in the member states of Russia, Armenia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, the group being headed by Russia, if there is an external threat to a nation, and not an internal one. But the Kazakh government felt that the external terrorist groups had infiltrated the riots and incited violence, which meant the CSTO troops had unprecedented permission to shoot protesters. In spite of the massive disarray of the previous week, two conclusions appear to be clear. The first is that once more, the Kazakh public have been denied their entitlement to create their own future. This is particularly impactful when thinking about, to some degree at first, protesters were really trying to fight for political change, but were eventually violently shut down after extreme complications. The other conclusion, which is definitely alarming for the other parties, particularly nearby in Ukraine, is that the Kremlin has moved unequivocally to save the Tokayev system, strengthened Russia's power over the region and influence over the Kazakh government, which could be exploited in the future, causing fear of Kazakhstan losing its dependence, which it recently celebrated 30 years of freedom just 2 months ago. Following these reports, in a more recent update, according to the Kazakh news website Tengri News, multiple deals to increase the communication and advance the education branches have been made, and also knowledge sharing for other resources and departments.
The January event struck for me close to home, literally, because it's my home country, so I felt fear for the future of the state. We've managed to interview students that were in Almaty at the time of the events and witnessed some part of them. The students have asked to remain anonymous. I don't think that anyone expected even a few days before that everything will escalate so fast. I talked to my parents a couple of days prior to the events and there was no sign of anything. I think this is also one of the reasons why people were so scared, because everything came so unexpected. Initially, I brushed off the news as it seemed surreal that such violent protests would take place. I mean, half a month prior to conflict, Kazakhstan celebrated its 30th independence anniversary, and although being an autocratic country, it was sort of a set an example for other former USSR countries because it was stable and growing economically. However, all the tensions between people and government were just piling up, especially after COVID lockdown and restrictions, when a lot of people lost their jobs and the government didn't help as much. So I asked students what they think was the reason for such events.
I think that similar situations have been expected for a long time, and for a long time the population has been under the pressure from the state, from the government, and reasons for that is the low wages, high prices, the gap between the rich. It is the mostly officials, security forces, and working class, and the high corruption of the city has always affected people's lives. I think that it is because people for a long time were silent.
Yeah, I agree with Dilnaz actually. And people are now glad that our new president is promising us to have new political reforms, political changes. And I'm not sure we can believe, we can trust him, because nothing really changed in Kazakhstan for 30 years. And actually, I want to tell you about my experience a little bit. Actually, there are pretty regular protests in Kazakhstan, but they're not as huge as they were in this January, because I personally know some activists, political activists, oppositioners, and they make peaceful actions. Like, for example, in December, they did a little bit, and in January, they were there on the protests, and even they were very scared of what happened, because they came there to just peacefully tell about their political point of views, but they could not escape this crowds, and they were that scared that they already wanted to go home, because they didn't expect explosions and policemen to come and force them to go home, something like that.
So initially people went to peacefully protest the rise of fuel. Well, the fuel didn't just rise, it doubled the price overnight, which obviously raised a lot of discontent. But at some point, something went wrong, and violence broke through, and in time a few hours, everything escalated to the boiling point. People were using guns, small explosives, brutally breaking into the shops, and fear increased. And students told about what they felt when they witnessed the events.
On the 4th of January, I was in Atrau, where a rally was held with the participation of 5,000 citizens. The first time such a large scale for the city, because the population of the Atrau is around 300,000 people. And on the 5th of January, I fell to Almaty, which became the epicenter of the protests. And upon arrival, the internet was turned off all over the country. Mobile communication worked very bad. And there are 4 military vehicles with 20 armed military personnel in each of them in the airport parking lot. Because mass rallies were already held in the city the night before my arrival. And I found a taxi in the airport for 17,000 tenge at a standard price of like 4,000 tenge. And taxi drivers in the city didn't have gasoline. All gas stations were closed, and we were driving almost without gasoline and could stop at any moment. And while driving home, I saw how burned out, overturned cars and trucks were lying on one of the main streets of the city. It is Tulibi Street. And the taxi driver told how his car was stopped by protesters, and he told how drivers took the state license plates from their cars and drove out them so that they wouldn't be identified. And when the anti-terrorist operation began with the involvement of the military from allied countries, I heard shooting and explosions every day. I think it happened near with me.
I think this all feels pretty scary. We were like walking through the city a couple of days ago, and we saw burnt houses, and we saw the state building in Almaty, and it's just like a ghost. It's absolutely black now, and no one is there. They're just like rebuilding it now, I guess. And also the weather became pretty, you know, foggy because of, I think it happened because of explosions that were held near the protesters.
It is very scary when you see the city you live in turn to a dark place, especially as interviewees said there was no sun and there was dust in the air from the explosives. So the few days when the events occurred, it was complete shutdown of internet, which is very scary nowadays. We rely so heavily on it. People rushed to withdraw money because no one could pay with their cards in shops, and ordering online was just out of the question. And this also means losing contact with your relatives and friends.
That also was pretty scary. Luckily, all of my family members were at home, big members, but I felt scared for my friends because I didn't know where they are. And I knew that, for example, Dilnas is coming to Almaty like in a couple of days when this all happened. And I was worried about, are they going to come home safely?
Worried about my relatives who stayed in Atrau, but however, they were more worried about me. But I kept in touch with them by phone.
I personally lost contact with my parents for a few days, and although I thought I wasn't scared so much for them because they were in home, well, in more or less peaceful city, when I finally heard their voices, I was emotional. There was no internet for a whole week, and I only managed to contact them calling via Skype to the landline. So 5th of January, Kasym Jomart Tokayev turned for the help to CSTO members, which was the first time in history when their organization was summoned. People have conflicting opinions about that, and now we listen to opinion of the students.
I think we all know that politics are pretty, you know, hard as a subject, and we don't know a lot of things. So some people thought that everything, that this was like a military intervention to Kazakhstan, and it was just a reason for, you know, for example, Russian soldiers to come here. And some people felt very unsafe because, are we going to be like a military base now? Are they going to leave or are they going to stay after the protests?
My first thought is that Kazakhstan will lose its independence because of such actions, but perhaps this was the government's plan to stop the rallies and riots.
Yeah, I agree. It's like, you know, ruining the independence of a country when military forces come to this country against citizens of this country.
Personally, I felt that I support the decision. Yes, I wasn't in the country, but I would accept any actions from the government as long as the violence and instability would be stopped. So the government implemented measures during the protests, including setting a fixed price on fuel, which was the cause of the conflict. This raises the question about the future of the country, as many important changes in the government were made. Now the students will talk about their future in Kazakhstan and whether do they think something like that would happen in the near future.
I do not think that this is going to happen in nearest future because all things that happened made people feel very unsafe, and I don't think they're going to risk everything and go protest again. And moreover, there were different types of propaganda in the mass media that made people think that protesters were the same as terrorists, and even though there were people that didn't mean anything bad going on the streets. And personally, I feel unsafety in this country, in this situation, because of an expectancy, sort of.
My goal before all the incidents was to travel the world and not to be tied to a certain place, but at the same time, I'm afraid that everything might happen again, and my family, most important thing in my life, may suffer from this. It is very, very scareful.
Elders of my family always tell me to leave Kazakhstan, like to move to another country and live there for the rest of my life, because they want me to have better future without corruption, without suffering from these political things. But personally, I do not know, because I actually really love my country and I love the city I live in, but I don't know what to do because I love Almaty, but I cannot live in such a polluted city, for example. So now I'm planning to move somewhere to start a career, to have new experience, working experience, maybe studying experience even. But I don't know if I'll stay here or live in another country for the rest of my life.
Future is unstable and no one can predict exactly what will happen at any time and place. We can only make assumptions, and these events only confirm that. I just hope for the best for my country, and here the documentary ends. Thank you for your attention.
This week on Tuesday, it was the Brit Awards, a brilliant awards ceremony which celebrates mostly British music and features international pieces while introducing new acts as well, with some brilliant performances from worldwide superstars such as Adele and Ed Sheeran. This week, I spoke to Hannah Goodban, a music student here at the University of Reading, to get her take on the winners and the key topics of the ceremony.
Having seen the Brit Awards last night,
or and seen the award winners. Is there any surprises to you or anyone that you felt was overlooked or missed out on an award?
Do you know what? I don't think there was that many surprises, to be fair. I think it's kind of hard because obviously, like, Adele won 3 Brits and like, she's amazing. She definitely deserved them. However, I do think because the categories were so huge this year, potentially some people might have got overlooked because there was a lot of different people that could have won. And like Adele said it herself, that there were so many people she was up against. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, she was quoted yesterday. She was constantly saying she was quite happy with the like the company that she'd seen herself in. We've run a poll here where we've got 66% of people do not think Adele is overrated. So it does seem that general public are in agreement that maybe she did deserve it.
That's the thing. Like, I think she's amazing and she definitely deserves like her that recognition. But with the categories so big, I feel like if I was in a category with Adele, I'd be like, well, it's very clear I'm not going to get it. But yeah, no, I think everyone that won an award definitely deserved it.
So you said there that you feel that if, you know, you were nominated against Adele, you feel like you've probably already lost. So in the scenario where at the moment it's sort of quote-unquote experts and critics who choose who is going to win the awards, do you think it would be better if it was fan voted for so that sort of hype didn't take the award and actually the most popular person that year would win? Do you think that would be a better way to decide the winners?
Yeah, maybe. Although saying that as well, I did notice that there was a lot of emphasis on TikTok this year. Like, so many of the... I can't remember which category it was now, but there was one category specifically that there was almost every song was known through TikTok, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and obviously very big in the media at the moment.
Yeah, and obviously, like, some of the categories were TikTok voted. So, yeah, it's a hard one. I feel like maybe if they did a half and half thing where they have, like, a cross-reference between what the critics and experts say versus public opinion.
Yeah, that's interesting. So more of a sort of a dual-wielding kind of thing in terms of how the winners were selected.
Yeah, because I think as much as the actual... how the public receives the song is so important, obviously... they wouldn't, the acts wouldn't even be nominated if the public hadn't really received the song necessarily well. But in the same instance, it's still important to have the musicality of it as well carried through because it's such a big award. I think it might be worth having the double layering because then you get both sides of whether the public or not enjoyed it and how it was in terms of its actual musical content. I imagine that's quite a difficult level of
extra accountability on top.
Yeah.
Well, so obviously following the 2022 Brits, people are already looking towards 2023. We've run a poll sort of asking people who they're excited to hear from. So we've got responses from people saying that people are excited to listen to Bakar this year with... Denzel Curry to release music, Red Hot Chili Peppers and the Arctic Monkeys all looking to maybe release albums this year or hopefully release albums this year. Are you excited to hear any of those or maybe someone else that is expected to release music this year?
Yeah, well, I'm excited to hear all of those, to be fair. Again, from last night, Sam Fender won his second award in 2 years. So it'll be interesting to see whether he tries to make that into a third or not. I'm quite excited to hear from Sam Fender. It'll be interesting to see if... because I feel like Olivia Rodrigo, a lot of her music is so TikTok-based. It'll be interesting to see whether TikTok has that same level of importance going into next year as well.
Yeah, whether or not she'll be able to ride that wave for that long.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah.
And finally, there was a lot of response on Twitter sort of going quite crazy when the nomination in terms of the best rock act. I'm just quickly like to get your take on whether or not you feel that the nominations this year included people like Coldplay and Tom Grennan, who maybe traditionally wouldn't have been considered rock and roll acts, and maybe, you know, more sort of indie or maybe pop style. So do you think maybe the definition of rock and roll, as proved last night, maybe has moved away from its core?
Yeah, it's a tricky one because, again, that's the category that Sam Fender won. And I wouldn't class Sam Fender as a rock artist. I think he's got obviously a lot of different genres going on, a lot of different influences. But he, I know the category is alternative slash rock, and that he is more on the alternative side. But I was thinking the similar thing when they all came out, that a lot of those are more alternative. And it is interesting to see as well that there weren't so many rock artists. And that's another thing about whether the categories are wide enough or too wide, that they bring in too many different genres into one category.
Well, guys, so does anyone here have any artists that they're looking forward to hearing from this year? What about you, Faris?
I definitely do. I heard Arctic Monkeys is dropping a new album. And honestly, hearing their last album, Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino, was a banger, straight banger. Very controversial, not a lot of people are into it, but I really like the direction that they're going into, and I hope they keep it up for their new album.
Yeah, it was definitely a controversial one that split opinions, with Arctic Monkeys performing locally in the summer at the Reading Music Festival, so any locals heading over to that will be able to see them soon and hopefully hear a new album maybe. What about you, Tamara?
Well, I'm thinking about Måneskin. I discovered them last year after Eurovision. I think they actually were nominated in Brits this year for the best song. And I think as well, Little Mix, love them.
Two very different bands. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
What about you, Donna? Have you got any artists that you're looking forward to hearing from this year?
I'm actually just looking forward to Kanye West's album drop. It's late, so I'm looking forward to when it will drop, because it's very anticipated right now.
Yeah, he's not one known for releasing albums when he says he's going to, and no, then could do it not at any random time.
Apparently you can't trust a genius.
Yeah, you can't.
Yeah, he's definitely a musical genius. I suppose some of his latest, performances have been a bit more controversial. But anyway, As Hannah said in the interview there, she noted how TikTok seems to be making quite an influence on music.
For sure.
Do you guys, so Faris, yeah, are you a TikTok user?
I am, sadly.
And and do you find that does affect how you're listening to music? Do you find that it's really influencing anything
100%.
For you?
Like, the new song recommendations that I've been getting for the past year are all from TikTok. And not only that, but it seems like the way people market new songs now is just to make like a little TikTok dance with it, and it spreads, it becomes viral. It's crazy.
Well, yeah, follow the money. What about you guys?
I actually think TikTok music is very, like, it has a lot to do with like the beat and dances, so they're very like jingle, not very musically packed and very like genius heavy, which is why I actually like Kanye, because a lot of his music is very impactful and very heavy stuff. Like, if you're interested in music, then that's definitely the genre to go. But TikTok is very playful.
Yeah, that's definitely true. What about you, Tamara?
Yeah, I think TikTok is like good for new artists as well, so they can reach out to their audience and maybe their song will go viral. And I think there are a few songs that were co-written by different people on TikTok, just making some songs over songs, and then they just became viral, and I think that's good. Yeah.
So we did run a couple of polls this week online. So also going back to what Hannah said as well, going to the Coldplay, we had an overwhelming majority with 87% of people who answered the poll with 112 answers that Coldplay are not a rock act. What would you guys say? Would you say Coldplay fall into the rock section?
Honestly, I can't say I remember too many Coldplay songs. It's a bit before my time. But I'd say they are a rock group.
Just a soft rock, like. Yeah, not something very hard.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think soft is probably the key word there. But we are basically out of time for today. So thank you very much for listening, everyone. That's goodbye from me.
And me.
And me.
And me.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you. Bye.